Midnight Clear you did with Ethan Hawke. Waking the Dead was with Billy Crudup and Jennifer Connelly. Mother Night, Nick Nolte, and Singing Detective Robert Downey. Was a lot of how those projects got made, you working stuff out with actors and then using that.
Actually, with my projects, it's been all over the place, and mine haven't mostly been cast based in the way that people think of it. It is true that a lot of indie movies get made, including some of the things I'm trying to do right now or whatever. The traditional thing is you get for famous people, famous actors to want to do your movie.
Yeah.
And because they're interested, you know, you go to money people and say, hey, I've got these famous people who want to do my movie, and then hopefully they give you money to do that. My movies, as luck would have it, didn't work out quite that way. Chocolate War, you know, was a case where it was really more about the book. The book was for the star. Midnight Clear was already a project that existed. You know, A&M Films had the book. It was William Wharton who wrote Birdie, which they also produced. And the financiers wanted a cast of kind of up-and-coming, interesting actors, but we went out and cast those actors. In other words, it was more the idea, we're making this movie. Now we do need to get a cast that they can feel okay about being able to sell. But it wasn't like I got Ethan and then ran around with Ethan Hawke saying, hey, I got Ethan Hawke, I'm making money.
Mm-hmm.
Ethan also wasn't at that point yet. I mean, he was sort of seen as a really interesting up-and-coming actor, but he wasn't yet at the point of being like a movie star.
Mm-hmm.
With Mother Night, it was a little closer in that, you know, we definitely needed a star for that role. But even there, what happened was that Ruth Vitale, who was running Fine Line Films, which was sort of the art house part of New Line, fell in love with the script. And she said, we'll make this film, but we need one of these three movie stars to make it, because we don't. And it was sort of Nick Nolte, Robert De Niro, and Daniel Day-Lewis. There was a whole series of anecdotes of going through that process. And we already had gone to Nick Nolte. Bob Whitey produced the film with me, and he wrote the script, and I directed, and we were old friends. And we'd gone down all these alleys trying to get it made, and one of the alleys was that we thought Nick Nolte would be great. And we'd sent it to his agents, who said he's absolutely not interested, and thank you, but no thanks. And so that then when Ruth brought him back up, we thought, well, that's not going to work. And then we went to De Niro, and after a lot of time, what we got back was that essentially De Niro might be interested in directing it, but he wasn't interested in being in it, which was like, didn't do me a lot of good.
Yeah.
And Daniel Day-Lewis was like, nobody could reach. It was like,
he's
checking around Europe and being a cobbler, and you know, you can give it, agents were like, you can give it to us, but God knows if we'll ever read it. So at that point, we were kind of screwed. And as luck would have it, and you know, like everything in life, kismet is so much a part of it. A casting director knew me from my acting days, called and said, I'm casting this like movie, this Hollywood movie, you know, called I Love Trouble, and we're looking just for kind of cool people that, you know, just to play like little parts in it. And I wasn't really acting much anymore. And I said, oh, well, you know, tell me about it, who's in it. And she said, Nick Nolte and Julia Roberts. And I was like, well, if you can get me in a scene with Nick Nolte, I would be very interested. And she was like, why? I said, oh, I'm just like a fan. It's not, you know. So I am in that movie for about 3 seconds as
handing the script to Nick Nolte.
Essentially, yes. And Nick, of course, you know, his agents had never told him about it. He's like, oh, I love Kurt Vonnegut. And you know, of course I'd read it. And then of course he lost the script. I didn't hear from him for like months, and I thought, okay, that didn't work out. But his assistant had been so sweet, so friendly, that I checked in with the assistant. And he said, you know, I don't think Nick ever wrote it. Can you send it again? And I sent it again. And then I got this message on my answering machine days later, like, it's Nick Nolte. I love this. And I actually thought Nick on an answering machine sounds like somebody doing a bad imitation. So I assumed he was Bob, my partner on the project, like talking about me. And it took me a couple of listenings to go, no, that's really Nick Nolte. And then we had Nick, who was I loved. I mean, that was really one of my very, very favorite acting experiences in terms of working with somebody. But so we managed to get the actor we needed, but it wasn't a case of having Nick and then going and getting the financing. That was the case where we had the financing and we had to get
dependent on right.
Stature.
So you're saying that his agent basically lied when they said that they'd shown the script to Nick, and that's SOP in Hollywood, is it?
Yes. You know, or, you know, I mean, again, there's, you know, they technically they're not supposed to lie, so like one of the things that they'll do, and I've had agents do this even with me at points in my career, and I'm not important and famous in the same way, so I'm sure it happens all the time. You know, for somebody like Nick Nolte, there's probably 5 scripts come in a day. So they just get on the phone and they say, well, we got these 5 scripts. You know, only one of them has, you know, money offer on it. The other ones aren't even fully financed. One of them is this really weird little low-budget movie. It's not very good, and they would have no money to pay you. And, you know, we just don't think it's something you should even bother about. Can we just pass?
And you'll be playing a Nazi, right?
And I'm sure he sort of went, yeah, sure, whatever. You know, so they don't actually completely lie, because I guess, I mean, mostly all because, you know, they could get really screwed if they do. But they don't – they can present things in a way where that client's never going to read something.
Right.
And that, I think, is very common. So certainly he didn't remember ever hearing about it. And sometimes I think they do lie and they just don't ever show it to them. I'm sure that happens too. But I've been on the receiving end of, you don't want to look at this. It's stupid. It's bad. It's this. It's that. And some years back, I learned, you know what? I don't want to trust my agents about that, even if they're good people. I want to make my own decisions. So now I've told them, don't ever do that. Really, you know, just let me read it. But my life, again, I'm not in so much demand that I can't read everything. If you're the hot person, I'm sure there is just more than you could ever read. So that it is an interesting conundrum of how do you access all the best material? And the problem with agents is even agents who are smart or great or whatever, their job is to make money. So if you're, you know, star actor X's agent, and one movie's going to pay your client $10 million and one's going to pay your client scale, you have a really big incentive to push the $10 million paycheck. So they're not necessarily the best person to be, you know, checking out your material for artistic quality.
Right.
So, which is why a lot of actors have close relations with managers or other people that become their balance to that. And then with Billy Crudup and Jennifer Connelly, again, it was the same thing, where really the star in some senses in that situation was Jodie Foster, who became an executive producer. We were trying to get that movie made, and we had gone to PolyGram because they were one of the people financing indie movies. And they had liked the script, but kind of, yeah, it's not commercial enough, we don't know how to sell it. They didn't jump at it. And then Jodie came and saw a screening of Mother Night and really, really liked it. And she had passed on getting involved with that, because she was at that point just starting her production company, and so we sent it to her, and she passed on it. And then she came and she was so sweet, and she came up to me and said, you know, I made a mistake. I wish I had helped produce that movie, and what else do you have? So I gave her the script for Waking the Dead, which she really responded to. And then her overall deal was at PolyGram. So she went back to them and said, I think we should make this movie. And so again, once she was involved, they wanted approval of the actors, but we didn't have to go get Tom Cruise. And so, like, Billy Crudup was somebody they saw as a really interesting up-and-coming actor. Jennifer had been in a bunch of things, so they approved of them, and they had, but they weren't like, go get the biggest movie star you can. So I've been pretty lucky, though. And then in terms of seeing Detective, it was sort of, everything was turned around on that one. They hired me. I didn't bring in Robert Downey. Robert Downey brought me in.
Oh.
That project was already sort of in pre-production. It's another director. And that director ultimately felt that they didn't feel comfortable trying to make it on the budget they had, which was pretty tight for what that story was. And so when that person fell out, Robert and I had acted together in Back to School.
Right.
And sorry, there's work going on in the house. I apologize. You're going to have some sound nightmares. And he and I had stayed in touch and talked about working together at some point. And he, you know, they basically got in touch with me, and that Robert was interested in me possibly as a director. And so we met a few times, and I talked about what I loved about the material, because I was always been a huge Dennis Potter fan. And he felt very comfortable with that, and that was basically how I got the job. But that was much more about him picking me than me picking him. And in terms of financing, that was financed by Mel Gibson. I mean, there was no financier other than Mel writing a check, because Robert was essentially uninsurable at that point. He was just getting out of jail,
right?
From, you know, when he was put in jail after a drug thing, and no one in town would insure him. And so the only way to get him back going again was for somebody to take a risk. And Mel was a good friend of his, and Mel had this material, and at one point, Mel had wanted to play the lead role when he first, I guess, optioned it. And instead, he decided that Robert would be great for it, which he would. And so Mel basically wrote the check to make the movie. So there was no having to satisfy, you know, if Mel was happy, then that was done. So I have never had a movie done the traditional way, which is just as luck has it. I mean, I have been involved with things that we were trying to go that way. I've been involved with things where I got an actor and we went around trying to get it set up, but it just never ended up quite happening that way.
And Singing Detective, I think that was what fired me up to want to write about you, because I was so impressed by that film. I couldn't believe the reviews. They were just so negative. And I just like, it's like they'd seen a different movie to the one I'd seen.
Well, I think, whenever you remake something, you're kind of setting yourself up. I was disappointed but not surprised by the reviews. Also, I got so many hostile letters and things while we were making the movie, and so many, how dare you guys be remaking this? And, I and journalists that came to the set while we were making it were like, so, you really set yourself up for a big fall here, huh? Remaking a climb. I mean, there were, I kind of had that. I saw where things were going way before anybody had ever seen the movie, so I was disappointed, of course, because you always want people to react positively. But I kind of was like, no big shock. And look, I even understand to a certain extent. There were things that they were there was depths and places they were able to go in a 6-hour version of the story that you could never go in an hour and a half version of the story. And Potter knew that in rewriting it, and but for anybody who said, well, the original, you got into more things and you went deeper into the character, which is absolutely true. I mean, it's not that's not wrong, and I think the original is brilliant. I think Potter very consciously rewrote to try to make it work in a different way for film, and in a way that I do feel worked. And I mean, I'm very happy with the movie, but I do. It's not like I think people who don't like it are insane. I just feel like they wanted the movie to be the miniseries, and they couldn't possibly be, because I mean, something that's whatever, I think it's actually close to 8 hours. It's just going to be a different beast. And I think people couldn't forgive us for not being that thing, which was an amazing thing. But the fact that Potter himself saw it as more, a little bit more confusing, and things being done by suggestion, and not and more truly all clues, no answers. That just didn't work for people. They wanted us to be able to ultimately lay out more story and backstory and explanation, and which is what it was. I mean, but yeah, I think my first interview at Sundance after we premiered the movie was, I don't remember who they wrote for, but their first question was, "How the fuck dare you repaint the Sistine Chapel?" It's like, "Oh, we're in so much trouble." And that was sort of the tenor of everything after that. And of course, the irony is that when the show first played on the BBC, it was a much more mixed reaction. I mean, now everybody was like, it was the greatest thing ever made. At the time, there was a much more divided critical response. But again, such is life.
So it's kind of a good segue to the TV movie thing that we discussed in email a little bit briefly. So because Singing Detective is your last film to date, and then in the interim between then and now, you've most well all your work's been in TV, but also this has coincided with this transition. Do you ever listen to Bret Easton Ellis podcast?
I know I haven't.
Because one of his running commentaries, the things that he's discusses, is this the question of whether we're in the golden age of TV and whether TVs have supplanted movies as the primary art form. And he's actually it's been interesting to listen to because he's changed his viewpoint through the process of basically battling this. Like he for a long time he was just saying no way, TV will never replace movies because TV is a writer's medium and movies is a director's medium and TV shows are never going to be able to capture that the thing that he loves about cinema or the thing that makes cinema cinema. But eventually he came around. I don't know what show it was exactly that did it, but anyway he did. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, I was already convinced by that point that TV was providing something that movies weren't. And I think part of it is funny what you're referring to with the Singing Detective is the long story, the pleasure of the long story, because it allows for that deeper immersion
Yep.
in that world.
Yeah. And it's true. I mean, look, as a fan, as a viewer, I love the fact that, if I love characters in a TV show, you can spend hour after hour and year after year getting to know them and explore them, and I think that's an amazing thing. I mean, I don't think it's true to say that they've replaced movies because I think they do slightly different things. But I think certainly they're the predominant cinematic art form right now. I think movies, sadly, you know, I think two things happened. I think TV got much, much better, and I think movies have generally gotten much, much worse, or at least the movies that we get to see.
Yeah.
I think if you go to some like interesting, weird film festivals, you can see some amazing movies. But the movies that get mainstream releases, for the most part, with the rare exception, are now, you know, Marvel comic movies and sequels, and, you know, that's become sort of certainly the Hollywood movie scene. But even the indie films now, it's so hard to get this attention when they're distributed. The number of really interesting films that get out there with any kind of visibility is small. So because of that, two things, TV getting really, really good, and movies kind of becoming more and more aimed at 14-year-olds watching stuff blowing up, I think you have had a change of what's the culturally more important thing. I still think there's some incredible movies getting made. And some of them sneak through and find their place in the world, and you know, and but it's harder. It's much harder right now. And TV, the audience, I mean, the more intellectual grown-up audience is watching TV. Because that's what's great and it's there. I mean, I also think, you know, if you give people a choice of, well, here's a really interesting story that's going to make you think about things, and you can go and push a button in your other room and watch it at your convenience when you feel like it. And here's something that you have to go out to a movie theater, spend the money, spend the time, do all that. You know, people are often going to default to, you know, watching the thing at home, especially when they're the older audience.
Yeah.
Is the audience for the kind of movies I like and the kind of, you know, I think kids want to get out of the house. So, you know, they want to go see an escapist Marvel comic movie because it's like, yeah, I want to get out of the house. I want to go away with my family. I want to go on a date with, you know, and be away. So I think they're serving different things, but I think the audience for more mature, complicated, morally ambiguous stories kind of fits really well with the ease of TV fitting into your life, and still having work and a job and things that you're doing.
Right.
So I think that it has changed, although I think, you know, the one thing that I've learned, and this is like my 40th year in the business this year, I think, or just now I've crossed over my 41st, is that it keeps evolving and changing, and that every time people make all sorts of statements about the way things are, right, by the time you finish making the statement, it's changed again. But right now, I do think that that's very true, and I think that TV is amazing. There's a lot of incredible stuff for the last 10, 12 years. It's been, TV's just gotten more and more interesting and fascinating. But I also think you're right. I think it is a writer's medium. It's not a director's medium. So for me, it's a very mixed thing on a personal, selfish level.
Yeah.
Because when I work on some of these really good shows, I get to work with terrific actors and really good writing. But it's not my show. When I do Fargo or Leftovers or Homeland or whatever, it's not mine. I'm there to serve their vision.
Right.
And there's a craft to that and an art to that and a pleasure in that. But I terribly miss doing things that are my passions as opposed to trying to fulfill somebody else's.
Mm.
And that is, so it's a mixed blessing. I would much, much rather do a good TV show than a bad Hollywood movie. I mean, it's night and day. I mean, getting to work on some of the things I've worked on, it's been just amazing. But would I rather make my very own movie on my own terms? Absolutely. And I haven't given up on that, although I will say for about the last 4 or 5 years, the TV work got so busy that all of my stuff just got pushed aside. And there's been a real conscious process just in the last little while in my life of going, wait a minute, I've lost track of my stuff. And actually life stuff as well. I mean, I feel like I wasn't getting my movie project, but I also wasn't seeing my friends. I wasn't seeing my family. I wasn't seeing my wife. I wasn't doing anything except directing TV. So I've gotten now much more, and it's because there's so much good stuff. I mean, it wasn't like, because I mean, every time I finish something, my agent would say, well, here's this. And I go, well, that's really good too. But I've learned that, yeah, I can't do every good show because there's too many good shows. So that I have to get much more picky and just go and disappoint a lot of people and know that I might miss out on being part of something wonderful, just to be sane and to be able to do my own things and maybe get my own movies made again and have a life. So I'm actually right in the thick of trying to wrestle with that.
So is it a danger in getting typecast as a TV director? I mean, is there a danger in that? As in, because people want to keep you as a TV director because you're doing a good job there, but it may not necessarily provide more opportunity to make film, or do you find that it does help you to develop a reputation to then?
You know, I don't know that it has a huge effect either way, for the kind of movies that I want to make, which are more independent movies. I don't think it's a big help or a big hurt. It probably does. If it's anything, it's probably more a help than a hurt. But you're never going to become a star director in TV enough that somebody's going to say, "Oh, here's $3 million to go do your project." So, you know, it does keep you relevant. It keeps you people maybe. As the years go, maybe people who maybe don't know my movies because there's, I mean, I gotta meet movie executives all the time now who are 18 or who are 28 years old or 20, you know. So it keeps you sort of in their eyes, somebody that, oh, I know your work. So it's valuable that way in terms of movies. But really, the problem is the kind of movies that I want to make, it's more about the economics than it is about like how well known are you as a director. It's convincing somebody that you want to take this artistic story that's not going to be an easy sell. And please give me your money anyway, even though this is going to be a tough sell. And here's how we'll make it make sense. And with that, the TV doesn't have a big thing, pro or negative. I think if I wanted to do Hollywood studio movies, I actually think it would be a big plus. Because at this point, people are moving back so easily. It's the opposite of what it was 15 years ago. 15 years ago, there was a real class division. There was a real sort of, you know, thing of you're a TV director or you're a movie director. And a movie director is above a TV director, and if you do TV, then you're a step below. And that's now gone out the window. And, you know, most of the TV shows, I mean, a lot of the people, you know, everybody from Steven Soderbergh to name a person, they're working in TV. I mean, they're developing shows, they're directing episodes of shows. So I don't feel there's anything of that. And if anything, the fact that you work on, I mean, I know that because I've worked on sort of some of these shows, people have come to me with sort of more Hollywood movies and said, oh, well, you did great suspense in this episode of Homeland, so come do this action movie. Except when you read it, go, yes, but that's much less well written and much less interesting, and you want a year and a half of my time as opposed to 3 weeks of my time. So that, no, I'm not going to do that. But I've actually experienced that people now look to TV as a place to get directors from that can do things really well and also don't expect to be paid as much as Martin Scorsese. And that, you know, and that they think they can push around because from their point of view, look at this big opportunity that I'm giving you, you know, do a whole big movie, which, of course, to me, going on to a studio project and being the guy that they think they can push around, this is like, it's just I'm such the wrong person for that, which again is an ongoing argument with my agents. It's like they don't get why my goal in life isn't to do a Marvel comic movie. It's like they just think that they think that's the weirdest thing.
Well, Robert Downey went that way, so why not
And
you?
I have so many directors, you know, who did that and were miserable. I mean, I have so many friends who like finally gave in and did the big studio movie, and most of them were like, "I want to blow my fucking head off." I just think if that's your personality, that you would anybody who wants to make these are the weird little movies that I love, you're probably not going to fit really well into that world, unless you get super lucky. The other thing I've been trying to do is the thing that splits the difference, which is develop my own TV stuff.
I was going to ask.
I mean, the problem with that right now, and I've got things in development now, and with some amazingly powerful producers and people who have incredible track records, the competition is bizarre because there is no actor, no producer, no director, no writer in Hollywood of any stature who doesn't have five TV projects that they're trying to get made. It is the weirdest thing. So I've had things with enormously, I mean, I won't say names because they're going to say, well, I don't like that you said things about me not getting anywhere. But I work with people that you would think, oh my God, if they want to do something, you're going to like every studio in town would be. And it's like, if your concept doesn't fit right within the niche of what a network's looking for, they won't go there because. It's quite literally like you go in to pitch something, and on the way out, Steven Soderbergh's coming in, and if and on the way out, as you came in, it was Ridley Scott leaving, and so they have everybody in the world bringing them everything in the world, and they can sit there and wait until they've got that perfect thing that fits their program of what it is that they want to do. So what we want to do, we're looking for something now that we want to get a period thing that's set in the '60s, and then when somebody comes in with that thing, they can do that, or even in just a bigger term. I mean, I had a show that I really loved, and that, like for example, National Geographic really, 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 really liked the script. But at the end of the day, even though there were elements of it that were rooted in real life, there just weren't enough for them, you know, because they were saying, "Well, as we're the brand that we're trying to be as National Geo is we want to be rooted in reality, even though it's fictionalized. And we just, this project just fell just short of that for them. And because there's so much good material, they could be picky and say, we really like this, but we're going to stick to our brand. Because having an identity in the crowded world of TV is very important to a lot of the networks. And so they want things that fit the identity, the audience, the profile that they want to do.
Right.
So it's very challenging right now to get something on the air. I'm trying. I've got something, I'm working on something right now with Warren Littlefield, who's, you know, the producer of Fargo, and he and I really hit it off and became friendly, and I love it. It's a book I've loved for years. Are we going to find it at home? I don't know. We'll see. I see how hard it is. You know, everybody assumes because there's so much good TV that just do TV, but it's like, yeah, it's not like everybody else hasn't noticed that too. So
how do TV companies even make their money now? It's kind of a weird question that I have, because, like, is it still through advertising, theoretically?
Well, it depends. I mean, the networks that advertise, it is through advertising. The premium networks, the HBOs, the Showtimes, the, you know, Netflix, Amazon, that don't do advertising,
yeah,
they make it other ways. The ones that sell premium cable subscriptions make it by the subscriptions. You know, every time, in a certain way, when you work for HBO or Showtime, they don't really even care what the ratings are so much. They care about how much the show is talked about. They care about how much it makes people want to have that channel. Because yeah, that's how they make their money. They make their money by getting their that whatever it is, $5 or $10 a month from subscribers. So they want as many subscribers as possible. So kind of a high profile, whether it's awards, whether it's critical attention, whether it's just that thing of, oh, it's a cool show that everybody's talking about, that's in that world the currency. Because if that show makes 1 million people subscribe, then that's $10 million a month coming in right there for that one show. So that's that part of the world. And also all these networks then also own their libraries. And then HBO owns that show forever. So they can put it on to streaming. They can put it, they can sell it all over the world. They can, there's a whole bunch of revenue streams that happen from a show. Whereas something that still sells advertising, advertising is important. But even there, other revenue streams are still huge. Like a network like FX or AMC or... they have to care about advertisers, but they also care about still, like, when that goes on Amazon Prime or when it goes on Netflix, people watching it there. You know, it's no one thing. It's a conglomeration of income streams from 15 sources that add up over time that make a show valuable or profitable.
Hmm.
It's not a, you know, it used to be very one for one. It used to be you were CBS or NBC or ABC. You know, you sold your ads for a certain amount of time, of money, and if you couldn't sell enough money on those ads to pay for the show and a profit, you didn't do the show. Now that's just a part of the business, even for them. You know, it's DVD sales, it's China sales, it's, you know, so God knows how much what's making. You know, which is why you sometimes see surprising things of what stays on the air, what goes off the air. Sometimes that show that seems like doesn't have much of a profile might be on the air for forever because it may be humongous in Asia, or it may be that you know, there's an audience that streams it like crazy. And there might be another show that seems like everybody talks about it or looked at it, but if those other streams aren't filling in, it's not worth going. So it's a strange world now because the finances are very complicated, and it's, you know, I'd love to get a look at the books myself, how they actually, what gets monetized how.
I open the door and my back is killing me, and I don't think that I can make it through the week. But then I remember I have something to help my way, some white and blues, and I don't care if I stay. And I've already lost my way, and I've already lost my way, and I've already lost my way. Oh no, oh no, oh no. White and blues will ease the pain as it goes through. White and blues will put your mind white and blues. Double B's are on my mind. White and blues, 20 minutes I'll be fine. And when I'm numbed out and my dreams are all gone, I can walk around with a smile so long. As long as I get that paycheck, 'cause it really brings me down when I am in debt. And I've already lost my way. And I've already lost my way. White and blues will put your mind at ease too. White and blues, double D's are on my mind. White and blues, 20 minutes I'll be fine. Well, I guess it ain't so bad, I still got a place to stay. And I still have women coming in every day. I still got Tim, I still got you, but sex and drugs won't always help me through. And I've already lost my way. And I've already lost my way. And I've already lost my way. White and blues will ease the pain as it goes through. White and blues will put your mind at ease too. White and blues, double B's are on my mind. White and blues, 20 minutes I'll be fine.
Have you thought about the ways in which TV and movies are used for propaganda purposes, and in terms of, like, personally what you want to be involved in and what you don't want to be involved in? And, like, is that something that you think about or that you've read about?
You mean in terms of politics and social effect and all that?
Well, propaganda, basically.
Yeah,
I mean, they say American people are the most heavily propagandized in the world, right?
Oh, sure. Well, yeah. We probably are, yeah. But certainly we're exposed to it constantly by everything. I mean, because, look, there's an element of propaganda in almost any communicative thing we do. I mean, we're always trying to show people our point of view, so it's always in there. So it's a question of what ideas are... And yes, absolutely, I do not want to ever be part of something. In fact, it would probably be my first commandment, is to try as best I can to avoid ever being part of something that would be promoting ideas that I think are bad for people. You know, whether they're about race or class or whatever, you know, I would always try to avoid things that say things that I don't believe in. That's very hard because sometimes you're not always sure how things will be perceived. Again, when you make your own movie, it's easier to be completely clear because you know what your intentions are. And even then, I've been accused of all sorts of fascinating things by people. You know, I had somebody tell me how, you know, what was it? It was like The Chocolate War was this fascist reactionary movie, and they had this whole theory about, you know, what it was saying, and it was like, wow, okay, I guess if I made what you said, that would be really bad. But, you know, so you can't control that in a certain way. You cannot, like, okay, it certainly wasn't what I meant.
Yeah.
But, you know, there'll always be someone who will interpret anything you do any way you can imagine. But with TV, it is trickier because I'm coming in as a director. I'm not part of the planning of the show. I'm not part of the backstage discussions. I'm not inside the showrunner's head. And sometimes the showrunners aren't inside their own heads because they're so busy just trying to tell the story that they're not thinking about the propaganda of what it's saying. So it is trickier because you come in going, I think I'm good with what this is saying, but I'm not going to control it. I'm doing my one little episode, and what the whole arc of the show says ultimately, and where people take it, I can't control that. So you just guess the best you can. But I mean, like, I worked a lot on Dexter, which is a show I really love because it explored a certain kind of darkness that I found both amusing and fascinating. But, you know, then you hear that somebody actually went out and committed a murder, you know, based on what they saw, and that's horrifying to me. And it's like, it certainly wasn't what I thought about going into doing the show, but it does say that, yeah, you don't know what ripple effect something's going to have in an overt way like that or in a more subtle way. And, you know, you follow your instincts the best you can, but yeah, there's always a danger that you're going to look back and go, wow, I didn't think that that's what this was about, and it's been co-opted as propaganda by people who see something very different in it.
Because that was Kubrick's nightmare. It came true with Clockwork Orange, apparently, seemingly.
Yes. But you can't, at a certain point, you can only know what your own intentions are. What's tough in TV is they're not your intentions. You're working for somebody else.
Yeah.
So then you're trusting what their intentions are. And often you don't know until you're already in the job. You know, and often you don't even know then. Because I might do episode 3, and by episode 10, it's like, oh, wow, this whole season has ended up going somewhere or saying something that I didn't even think it was.
Right.
So you can't completely insulate yourself. But like I said, even with my own movies, I mean, you know, there were people who thought that in Waking the Dead, I was saying that Jennifer Connelly deserved to die for being a leftist person politically. And it's like, okay, I don't know how to respond to that, but that's what they took from it.
Right, and Brian De Palma, the response to Dress to Kill, of course, was
absolutely
vitriolic.
But specifically that they felt he was endorsing the idea that for example, Angie Dickinson's character deserved to die for having enjoying sex. And I know, because I know Brian, and I know the script, and I know that wasn't his intention, but, you know, and then you get into a very fascinating conversation about, well, is what's important the artist's intention, or is what's important its effect? And I actually think that is a really interesting, in any art form, thing. Because if you say something and people take it another way, you know, then the whole issue of, well, what's responsibility and what can you control? That's a very interesting, and I don't know what the answers are, but it's a sort of fascinating thing to try to examine.
Yeah, that's what I was doing with Seen and Not Seen. And I think it is fair to say that what we communicate is what's received, not what we think that we're communicating, right? Because it's a two-way thing. But I think the whole question of art and the effects and that you're talking about there is, it's not exactly separate from what I was addressing, but I think it does muddy the waters a lot in terms of, like, there's a big difference between an artist who's struggling to present a vision to the world and is maybe confused. Sam Peckinpah with Straw Dogs was a good example, because I think that genuinely did end up a bit fascistic, but I think because Peckinpah was confused, not because he was working for the CIA, you know, to promote rape or what have you. But so there's that, and that, you know, that's just part of the struggle that all of us are in. But then there's the reality that the CIA and the military are involved in the film industry and in TV, and they do create, I believe, I mean, that's why I asked how much you'd read about this stuff, they do create shows as actual vehicles for propaganda. I mean, Top Gun would be an example of a movie that was created to, you know, increase recruitment for the Air Force, right? So then that's, I mean, that to me is, well, they're both equally interesting, but I guess I was referring more to the latter. So right. With a show like Homeland, I haven't seen it, but the reason I haven't seen it is because, to me, I can't imagine a show like that wouldn't have been designed and funded as a kind of propaganda, just because it's such a politically important subject, right?
Well, actually, I mean, in terms of Homeland, you know, Alex Ganz, who runs the show, is a very interesting guy, and he's sort of obsessed with politics, but his politics are, I mean, the interesting thing about Homeland is it enrages people on every side of every issue it deals with, and
right.
That's sort of his thing. I mean, I've never felt on that show that there's an involvement of the government, or that, in fact, a lot of people in government hate that show, you know, because he basically, his whole thing is saying that both sides are right and both sides are wrong, so that everybody ends up really frustrated by it. And I don't know that he always succeeds, because it's such a hard thing to try to do, but I've never felt, like, I've done like 5 episodes of it now, I've never felt an agenda to say anything that would be liked by the CIA. And in fact, if anything, the further the show has gone on, the more clearly malignant, I think, what even he refers to as the shadow government and the, you know, the permanent government is. That,
interesting.
You know, I mean, now again, Alex being somebody who's fascinated by the ambiguities of life, is somebody who would say, I don't know that you could successfully have a country that has no secret service, that doesn't operate in the shadow world. In the real world, if you don't do that, you're sort of doomed. But at the same time, I don't know how you do that and not trample all over human rights and civil rights. And I mean, when I spent time talking to him, I think he's somebody who's deeply torn by that. But, you know, clearly, for example, this season, with, you know, it's, you know, this year particularly is coming off on this much more on the side of the CIA as a cancer than it is that the CIA are heroes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's so far been about, you know, a Muslim kid who that the FBI decides to set up as a, you know, so they can arrest somebody for being a terrorist, even though he hasn't done anything. So I certainly don't think that. Now, that said, I think there are fair complaints about Homeland from people on both sides, because there, I think there are times when it tilts itself one way or the other.
Right.
But I do know the intent on that show, and I honestly believe the intent on that show is to do that, is to say there is no truth. And so I don't feel like there's a, like I say, I don't get the feeling that Alex is like the most beloved guy, you know, when he deals with the CIA and his contacts in that world. So that one I don't feel, you know, I'd be interested if you ever did watch the show to hear what you think.
Yeah.
Now, that said, there are moments that it is patriotic and flag waving. And Alex would say, well, but I am patriotic and I do love America and I think there are things about America that are great. And I do think that there are things that the CIA does or spies do or that are part of the reality of life. But that doesn't mean when we start dropping drones on people and killing, you know, villages full of people at a wedding, or when we arrest people for things they haven't done, or that we're not seeding our own destruction. So he's an interesting guy in that way, and that is the very thing that interests him.
Hmm.
So,
yeah, well, maybe I will watch it. I mean, I'll try it, but I mean, because I do like spy shows, and my wife, well, not shows necessarily, but movies, and the subject of espionage interests us for sure. And it isn't always as cut and dried as, like, one of the things that I say we now, because we kind of watch TV shows as one organism. I don't know if you have that experience with your wife, but it can be very sort of symbiotic. One of the things we've noticed, the shows that we don't like and we stop watching that we feel are kind of propagandizing, it isn't necessarily overt or explicit in terms of government patriotism or agendas. It has to do with pushing values, like not necessarily all American values, because it doesn't even have to be confined to America, but a certain value set that, like, even a show like House of Cards, we ended up giving up on, not just because I felt it lost quality, but also it just seemed to be subtly promoting the values that it was supposed to be questioning.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and look, I think on a very subtle level, but that goes back to where I think there is overlap with the two things of like what the artist's intention, and, you know, there is the overt thing that you were talking about literally the CIA and the government, you know, helping to fund certain things, and if you do a show about the military and if you want the military's cooperation, you have to do certain things, and them getting inside of corporations and saying, you know, we'd love a movie that would say this, and there is that whole very overt element of it. But then there is that confused thing of people doing shows, and I don't even know that they know what they're doing and what they're saying and how it might be, you know, and it is more of that other confusion. And I actually don't think those are two neatly divided things. I think there's overlap at times, because as a person doing a TV show, you know, you've got your own desire to communicate. You've got a desire to communicate to a wide enough audience that you're not just preaching to the people who just completely agree with you. So you have one, you're possibly moderating certain things, so that at least you can get the ear of people or the eyes of people who don't just go, oh, that's a liberal show, that's a conservative show, you know, because America is so divisive. So you don't want to just position yourself as, oh, we're on this side about everything, because then you're really limiting your audience. But in the process of doing that, you can't help but starting to subvert whatever your position is. I mean, the second you start compromising, like, well, we don't want to lose this audience, you're already now trapped in something.
Yeah.
Then you've got the network or whatever that's financing you, who may put subtle pressures on you that, for reasons that are obvious or not obvious, for reasons that they're getting. And how much of that filters through, how much of that doesn't, and how much, you know. So that I do think you end up with a bit of a muddle around this, where it's not neatly just artist confusion. Like, I thought that the Straw Dogs version thing is a great example, and I do think that's a case exactly of a film that I do feel like is kind of pro-rape and fascist and all that. I don't think that's what he meant to say, but it's effective. I think that's one extreme, and then, like, literally the Top Gun kind of, hey, you're going to work with the Air Force and make a commercial for us. But I think there's a lot of stuff that has some of both, and that's part of what makes it so intractable, is that there are places where does one of those start and the other stop, and what's intentional and what's unintentional, and you know, are the people doing House of Cards meaning to say that, or is it subtle pressure that they have responded to, or are they not even thinking about it? That's a sort of fascinating thing, because art is propaganda by nature. You're trying to get people to think things about life, but yet the process of doing like a TV show where there's so many people involved, you know, it's not even like, I mean, a movie's a little bit more one person's version. TV is like, you got so much in there, or a studio movie, that it's like really hard. You know, I mean, Straw Dogs, again, is very much a one human being's version. I mean, that was Peckinpah's movie. Yeah. And whatever's good or isn't is all about what's inside his brain. TV, there's a network, and there's a production company, and there's the showrunner, and there's all the other writers, and so it's like, it's groupthink, it's getting influenced by the people around you, it's, you know, writers' rooms and TV are constant places of roiled arguments and conversations about what the show is about and what it's saying. So it's very challenging, I think, to have that one person's point of view thing that a great independent kind of movie has. It's closer to a studio movie that way. So it's a fascinating question. I mean, an interesting one, but it's to deal with, but it's a very hard one to parse apart in a neat way, I think.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, with seeing and not seeing, what I ended up seeing is that, well, like you're saying, everything is propaganda, because to the extent that it's trying to convince or draw the viewer in, or the reader into the point of view of the person who's communicating, right? So it's trying to influence us, whether it's just to have an emotional response. I say just because that's the main part of it, really. But, you know, it can't be ideologically free, because the people making it have ideology. So yeah, what I discovered when I started deconstructing my own movie love was how I had been propagandized without knowing it, in ways that were much more subtle. So like Dirty Harry, for example, I knew even as a teenager that Dirty Harry was right-wing propaganda, because I read Pauline Kael, and so she told me, right? So I was informed, and there was no way it was ever going to turn me into a Nixonite. But it did, you know, in subtler ways, it sort of reinforced the part of me, the neurotic part that wanted to be powerful, that wanted to identify with Clint Eastwood, and that believes that might is right, or that force is a way to resolve problems. And that's not a small thing, right? That's at the root of it. So that very deep level, there's nothing that we can watch or absorb that isn't going to have those hooks in it. And we had this experience watching Fargo, which both my wife and I love. We actually watched the second season first, which I know you worked on, and because we'd given up on the first season, but we loved the second season so much we went back to the first season. And by the end of it, it was kind of funny, because we really enjoyed it, but we also kind of realized that we've just been propagandized, because it is in certain ways it's period, so it's in a way it's kind of much cleaner, but it's reinforcing the idea of kind of the good police and just the American values, and that the system works, and that just in this very subtle way that's reinforcing a kind of what I consider to be an illusion, which is that The system as it is more or less functioning, right? It's an illusion that's more and more of a luxury, right, in 2017. So a show like Fargo can appeal to the nostalgia and the desire to sort of rekindle that illusion, and that's part of its appeal, but it's also that also you could see that it couldn't be kind of an insidious kind of propaganda to some extent. I mean, it didn't put us off the show. It was just a sort of wry kind of raise of the eyebrow. Okay, we loved it, but, you know.
Well, and that's the fascinating multiple level conundrum of so many things, because in other ways, Noah Hawley, who created Fargo, and that really, if I've ever worked on a show that was one person's vision, it is his baby, and he spends a lot of time talking about themes and what the show is about to him. And in many ways, certainly in the second season, there was a lot of stuff that he talked about that was much more in terms of social criticism.
Mm.
That was the opposite of that. And yet, I see exactly what you're talking about as well, and that's where it gets complicated.
Yeah.
This does create these police that are very positive characters and reinforces certain sort of capitalistic / fascistic / cliches that we've all... But he's also, in his mind, making a show about how small businesses have been taken over by corporations and that, you know, the corporate world is just a stand-in for what happened in every other world, where these cold corporate people come in and basically kill off anybody who actually had creative impulses and were trying to do something in a human way. But he kind of was trying to make it sort of darkly funny by making it in the world of you know, organized crime.
Yeah.
But by contrasting like that family of like kind of, that really was a family with this kind of cold, you know, cold bureaucracy, he was basically taking on, you know, I know he was taking on Vietnam and what Vietnam did to people, and that this was a generation that came out of Vietnam in season two, and all the people that were broken by it, and that. So it's interesting because I think from his point of view, I think he thought he was being sort of anti-establishment, and yet absolutely I can see your points about, but it's still living within the confines of certain other things that we all are taught constantly about: police are good, this person's bad, you know. So it can be very complicated that way, because I actually think you can be doing two things at once and actually pulling two ways at once, because there's so many levels of what lessons we're teaching.
Yeah. Well, it's the medium itself glamorizes, is what's occurring to me. I think Coppola had to face this after he'd made The Godfather, which in every way was an attempt to show the rot at the core of the American dream, etc., etc. But he ended up, I mean, the Mafia loved that movie, right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think it's the same thing that's going to be true of De Palma's Scarface, but Godfather's the greatest one, because it really was, that was a film about the rot of the American dream.
Yeah.
And yet, for most people, it was a glamorous movie about gangsters that they want to be just like.
Yeah.
And that's a fascinating thing. I feel like that goes on all the time, and I don't know how you avoid that.
No, I don't think you can entirely get around it, because if you totally deglamorize, nobody's going to succumb to it. They're not going to receive it. So did you see True Detective?
I saw the first season. I didn't see the second.
Right, so... It was the second one that was particularly interesting to me. I loved it. My wife and I both loved it. It went a bit wrong in the middle, but it came back by the end. But most people, as you probably picked up, maybe why you didn't see it, most people hated it. And it's unbelievably dark. And except to the extent I'm saying you can't help but glamorize when you fictionalize, it really deglamorizes. Like, the characters are just completely fucked up. They can barely articulate. You know they're all doomed. It's a downer. The show is a real downer. My wife and I happen to love downers because we like realism, you know. And yeah, you can't really get realism through entertainment unless it's incredibly bleak. And it was. And so what occurred to me when I was writing about True Detective, the second season, and how reviled it was that in a way the public response was confirmation of how effective it had been. Because public don't want to have their illusions burst. I mean,
no, in fact, everything you're saying now really makes me want to see it. That makes me now very intrigued by it. I got influenced by the thing. Yeah, I heard people always as good as the first season, and there's so much good stuff. That it wasn't like I was avoiding it, but it was like, oh, well, if it's not as good as the first season, let me catch up on all these other things.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to hear somebody like you, who I respect, give very clean reasons that I can imagine I would really respond to that.
Mm.
So I would like to see it for myself, because like you, I often like things that other people find unbearably dark, because to me they seem also very honest. And I like the lack of glamour, but I also am willing to acknowledge that most people don't share that taste. But I've definitely liked things that other people have gone like, oh, that's just too depressing. And I'm like, I don't know if for me there is such a thing as too depressing if it feels emotionally impactful and honest. I mean, there's a certain kind of self-satisfied nihilism that I find not always effective, because it's dark, but it feels like a college student's idea of dark. It's like, you know, look at the darkness that I show you. You know, but when I feel darkness comes from an honest place, to me, that's incredibly powerful and emotional. And as somebody who has a tendency towards depression, and you know, I find that incredibly potent. As and I am not put off by it, as long as it feels like it's coming from an honest place and not a kind of put on pretending to be artistic place.
Well, it's definitely not depressing. But I think if people who aren't comfortable with depression as just a natural part of being alive, and who specifically watch movies to escape those horrible feelings, or TV shows, then yeah, it's like it's almost like you're breaking the contract. If you, you know, it's I'm thinking of, there have been films that have done this, and they've really, I mean. Peeping Tom, I think, is coming to mind, although I'm not a fan of Peeping Tom, but it did sort of break a contract in some way with the audience, and the audience turned against the director for it. The Counselor, I think, is another example. Like, the Counselor breaks the contract, which is that the hero will be heroic, and if he can't save the girl, he will avenge the girl, just at the most basic level.
Right.
It breaks many of the traditions. Did you see The Counselor?
No, I didn't. But
right. Well, I don't know if you'd like it, because there are reasons to dislike it besides it being so dark, but because it's very, what's the word? I don't want to say stilted, because that's a negative thing. It's stylized. It's very stylized. So it's Cormac McCarthy, and his dialogue is theatrical. It's like a Greek theatre, except it's in the modern world of crime. So it's all dialogue, pretty much, and the dialogue's all incredibly profound. So it's not realism.
Right.
But it's presenting a world that is unbearably realistic, which is the Mexican drug cartels, you know, American graft and greed and corruption in the legal and the political world and so on. So it's kind of it's like a religious or an archetypal description of you know, postmodern corruption and depravity in the Western world. And but it breaks the contract with the audience in these various different ways. I was just giving the most obvious one, which is everything goes horribly wrong, and you know, the protagonist doesn't even react the way he's supposed to react. He just has a meltdown and falls apart in a hotel room, right? So it's, in some ways, it really is ultra realistic. And I thought it was absolutely fantastic. I thought it was one of the outstanding films.
I'm actually going to make note of this. I want to see that.
And it was totally reviled. I mean, you must have read the reviews.
Yeah, well,
to some extent.
I'm always, you know, the review thing always it's confusing for me, because I think reviews are horrible, and often I don't agree with them. I mean, I think the whole process of reducing art to a few snappy comments is really difficult. And yet, in a world where there's so much to see, sometimes it's like, well, I don't know what else to do. You know, it's like, you know, it's like where there's hundreds of TV shows and movies, it's like I end up falling into being influenced by them without meaning to be.
Yeah, or even just the percentage on Rotten Tomatoes, right?
Yeah. It's horrible, because it's like so anti-art, and yet, except for something like that, look, my favorite thing is if a friend or somebody I respect says this is something that's really special, then I will. That's my first thing that will make me want to see something. But beyond that, you know, if I've got a choice of, you know, 100 movies that all I could watch, I sometimes end up on Metacritic or Rotten Tomatoes, and because I don't know where else to start.
Yeah.
And then I try to read between the lines, and I try to actually click on some reviews by some of the writers I find more interesting. It's like, you know, I often find that Jonathan Rosenbaum is interesting in his takes on it. And there's certain critics that I think are particularly, I don't always agree with them, but they have insightful things to say. But even there, I don't always agree with them. You know, it's like, it's very hard. It's another of these contradictory things, because I wish reviews would just go away and everybody could just have their own opinions, and yet I don't know how, in a world over flooded with material, you start to sort through them. So a weird thing. I mean, what do you do? I mean, how do you pick? Are you influenced by reviews? Do you?
I do it the way that you're describing. I use Metacritic, and yeah, I just go for the green ones. I know it's terrible because I would miss out on United States of Leyland, some of your films, Ethan Hawke's film, which I loved, Hottest State. There's movies that just get totally tanked. I'll be missing these because I'm going that way. But anyway, and then I go and then I watch the trailer. Basically, a trailer usually lets you know, although The Counselor, I think a combination of the reviews was so bad and the trailer didn't. It's such an odd movie that it didn't. What you couldn't really communicate it in a trailer, or at least they failed to. So I actually, I can't remember why I ended up watching it, because I know I decided I wouldn't see it, but somehow I ended up watching it and was completely astonished. You know that experience you have when you just you're sure that something's going to be bad and you keep waiting for it to get bad and it isn't. Like, you were misinformed, right?
Well, and then there's also a whole psychological thing of that, too, which is when I've seen, like, for example, sometimes I need to watch something if I'm thinking of an actor for a role or whatever. So I might need to watch a film that got trashed by critics. So not everything I watch is for pleasure. So I'm looking at a production designer or whatever. So I might watch a film that's like everybody hated. And not only am I often pleasantly surprised, but I also know there's a psychological element to that, because
yeah.
I've been set up to think this is going to be awful.
Yeah. So
suddenly, when it has strengths along with the weaknesses, it's like, wait a minute,
yeah.
This has got good things in it, and I'm excited by those things.
Yeah.
Vice versa, I also get really pissed off, but when I've been overhyped
yeah.
on something, because by the time I see it, I almost can't enjoy it anymore.
Yeah.
Because everything now enjoys it, I guess to an extent, but it's even more. It's so divided that something's either the worst movie ever made or the best movie ever made.
Yeah.
So by the time I've read 45, this is the most incredible movie ever made reviews, I know that when I see it, I'm going to be struggling against a human tendency to go, no, it isn't.
Yeah, yeah, negative identity. I know, it's like being colonized, isn't it? You're colonized by all these other opinions, and so then you, in order to try and get free of them, you end up taking the opposite.
Yep.
I had this experience absolutely irrefutably with The Shining, because I had always disliked that movie, and I tried to watch it so many times because everybody kept telling me how great it was, and I kept thinking, I've got to, why don't I like it? I should like it. It's about a writer going insane. What could possibly be more interesting than that? And so I must have watched it half a dozen times, and every time it just failed, and so I ended up taking a really strong position. This is a shit movie, and nobody sees it but me. And then what happened was that I did a podcast about Kubrick and why he was overrated, and I talked about The Shining and why it was a bad movie. And then I watched it after that, and in that case it was the opposite, because I was thinking, well, I hope I really hate it because I've gone on record. and I loved it that time. So it's like, oh, how did that happen?
Might take a year.
Well, look, you know, it's as we all know too. It, I mean, art is by nature an interaction with the artist and the person, and you're a different person at different moments.
Yeah.
I mean, I know so many movies, books, paintings, pieces of music that I thought were the greatest thing when I was 22. I think are silly now, and vice versa. You know, I mean, as I've changed as a human being, or even the mood I'm in. I mean, there've been things I've watched that were like, oh, I hated that, and I'll rewatch it in a different place. You know, a month later.
Yeah.
It's just, again, a different experience, and I think that's great. I think that's what's great about art, is that it is an interaction. It isn't just a thing. I mean, for me,
yeah.
Art is not a thing in a vacuum. It's like, you know, it's like quantum physics. Like, things only exist, you know, they in relation to each other. Or, well, it's not quantum physics, it's true. But that, and I guess I feel that way about movies or art too. It's like, it's part of your experience is always who you are and what you bring to it.
Yeah.
And that whether that's the colonization of reviews or whether it's the experience that you've had that in some way and subliminally links to what you're watching in that movie that makes you repelled or drawn to it, or a piece of music in the movie that speaks so deeply to you that suddenly it opens you up emotionally to things that you might otherwise think were trite or silly. Or, I mean, I think there's so many ways that movies operate on our subconscious, particularly movies, because they involve so many other arts at the same time.
Yeah, well, that's the appeal of them, isn't it? Because they're as close as we can get to dreams.
I completely agree. I absolutely think more than maybe any other art form, maybe some music, maybe not, maybe dance, some. But I think it generally, movies kind of bypass the intellectual process. Like, for me, it seems like when you read, it's an intellect first, emotion second. It's like you analyze, and then you have an emotional reaction to the things that you've analyzed, like the ideas that you got by analyzing the words. Movies, I think, when at their best, often just go right through that part of your brain, just like deep in the amygdala kind of place where it's you're having a dream and you're responding, and you don't know why you're responding. I mean, some of my most powerful experiences with movies, I've been crying or laughing, and I couldn't even tell you why until later I went back and analyzed. But it's bypassing that whole intellectualization that I think most art invites you to do and forces you to do, so that you can then have a reaction. So I think that's what I love about movies, is that I have the reaction first and the thought second, and I think much of our society doesn't let you do that or help you do that. So that's part of why I think movies and TV are such a great like alternate to the reality that we live in most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think most of what we do is we think about things. We think, oh, I think this about it, and now I'm going to feel that about it.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's the appeal for me, and I guess I'm thinking it is for everyone, really, of movies and TV shows, is that is related. Is that it's a way to engage with reality. Obviously, it isn't reality, but it's a simulation that's very convincing, and be totally relaxed because there's no pressure on us. Like, it's a completely passive experience, and yet we're engaged with stuff. So similar to when you're dreaming, like you're...
Yes, but as when you're dreaming, it can also rile up very deep places.
Yeah.
I mean, I've wept as intensely at movies as I have on hearing of the death of a friend.
Yeah.
And I feel those were really curious, because it affected me that deeply. Even if it was an artificial thing that was making me have that reaction, the reaction was real and stayed with me often that way. I mean, you know, there are things in movies that I know imprinted me and changed me for better and for worse. I mean, there's good things about that and bad things about that. But I definitely think that it can have profound, even though it is just a story being told, it can affect you in a very, very deep way, almost like a real experience can, which is a kind of really interesting. I mean, I feel like that's something you've written about a lot from the things that I've read of yours, that you are drawn very much to that line about, you know, the way that we're affected by cultural things.
Yeah.
And is that real? Is that not real? Is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? You know, it's a very complicated thing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the more deeply something can affect you, the more it can influence you, obviously, and that can is a double-edged sword, to reduce it to a platitude. But I mean, the more art can profoundly move us and potentially enlighten us, the more it can have the opposite effect.
Absolutely. No, I think art is by nature neutral. You know, I mean, not each thing of art, but I mean, I think there's nothing good or bad about that statement. It just is. Seem to need it. It seems to feed something in us. But yes, it can feed the Nazi in us, and it can feed the angel in us, and it can feed the killer in us, and it can feed the compassionate in us. And sometimes not in obvious ways. And sometimes things that seem to be doing one are doing the other, or things are doing both simultaneously. And I almost feel at a certain point, you know, unless something is overtly propaganda, you can't even control it because it's so subtle and complicated. I mean, I think, yeah, if it's Lenny Beeson's trolley, you can start going, okay, yes, that's a problem. But beyond that, it's so weird of like what something does and doesn't mean. And again, how different that can be. I'm sure you felt that with your writing. I've certainly felt it with films I've made. When, again, like we were talking about before, when you start I start reading reviews or essays that people wrote or whatever about my own films, where I don't even recognize what they're seeing in it. But that doesn't mean they're not seeing it. Mm. And you can't even control that. So it's like, well, how do you say, like, if somebody thinks that the chocolate war is a pro-fascist metaphor, and is, how do I, there's nothing I can do to affect that. And it makes me feel kind of weird, but it's also like, nothing I can.
Well, no, unless you wanted to retract it. But I suppose, I mean, it may not be a good example because he may have just been gone off on a tangent that was entirely personal and basically meaningless. But if there's some validity in that interpretation, it could be very interesting for you because it could be an unconscious thing in yourself that you're, of course it's adapted from a book, so you might discover that that was what the writer was doing but you didn't realize it, and so on. I mean, as I said, it's probably not a great example because it may not be the case with that one, but it certainly could happen.
But it's also a question of then there becomes an intellectualization process the other direction of, you might, somebody might get a meaning that you meant in one level, but what they intellectually think that meaning means takes another level. And I know that sounds kind of weird, but like, yeah, with the chocolate war, like, I was basically, for me, I was thought I was making a movie saying, be careful if you fight City Hall that you're not doing exactly what City Hall wants you to do. Be careful that you're not thinking you're joining, that you think you're fighting the system, and yet you unconsciously you've been actually joining the system.
Right.
Now, what this person thought was that was so dispiriting that that on some level I was saying, so give up and just let the fascists win, because you can't help but give them what they want, so anything you're going to do.
That's funny.
So they were correctly interpreting something I was saying, but what meaning they gave to that.
Right.
And so then they get to a whole, like, okay, well, is that right? Is that wrong? I mean, I could see how they got there.
No, that's entirely subjective, isn't it? And it's interesting because you changed the ending to make it less defeatist, I think, rightly.
Yes.
Because I remember being frustrated by the book, and usually I like downer endings just because I consider them realistic. But in that book, I thought it was gratuitous, as I know you did too. So it's interesting that even so, you still got that response. But you know, like the ideological thing, I think in a way it's the least, well, it's a bit complex because it's, but I mean, you were saying that Leni Riefenstahl, that's easy and that's cut and dry, but of course that's only because we're now in the present, right? And we can look back and say, well, that didn't work out too well. If they'd won the war, we'd just be saying it was a masterpiece. So,
absolutely right.
So we don't see the propaganda in our own time.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, what I was trying to get at with seen and not seen is it's not really about, it's not that one ideology is better than another, it's that all ideology dehumanizes us and divorces us from our innate sense of what's true, just as all propaganda, you know, interferes with our discernment abilities. So it's more about recognizing how we let culture infiltrate us and reconfigure us internally and turn us into something that we're not. And why we do that, you know, why we're drawn to these dissociative fantasies in the first place, and if there's a way to kind of have our cake and eat it and still enjoy them without being kind of further dissociated or further colonized by them.
It's a really difficult and interesting question. I mean, it's fascinating, and it's probably at the heart of any societal, because societies are, to a certain extent, built around myth, ideology. I mean, it's almost like, can you truly have a society free from anything that's doing that? Whether it's religion, whether it's art, whether it seems so innate in human beings that we kind of organize ourselves around ideological constructs of some sort or other, and that gives us a basis to start a society from.
Yeah.
You know, a belief of some sort, which inherently, immediately is going to be flawed, because you're already pre-deciding what's a good thing, what's a bad thing, you know, in a world where that's not ever going to always be true.
Yeah.
So it's almost like the very act of anything other than pure anarchy involves a certain amount of propagandizing of the human soul. And it's like, how do you draw the line of what the best level of that is? And I have no idea what the answer to that is. But it is, I don't know that you can have a society that doesn't have some of those elements that are giving you a shared myth, or whatever you want to call it, of what the moral and ethical ideas of that society are going to be. And that's inherently problematic and yet unavoidable. And I don't, it's a really tough thing.
Yeah, well, Plato outlawed artists, right? But then that was because there's an autocracy, right? So then it's just simply, it's all top down, and there's no even illusion of democracy, and so that doesn't seem a viable alternative either. I think it has to be an individual question, is my answer to that. Like, rather than thinking about how to build a better society, which always seems to only create worse ones anyway, in my opinion, it's more about how, as individuals, you know, how can I move closer and closer to an expression that's true. Like you were talking about earlier, in the more general sense of being more Zen,
mm-hmm.
how can I be able to fully express my feelings and my experience in the moment without actually being possessed by it or consumed by it? You know, that thing is like, there's something in us that wants to express that's Zen or Tao, or the, you know, the signal that's coming from the deepest place within us that can't be propagandized. So finding a way to express that through art, that seems like a worthy goal. And as a writer, the simplest way to reduce it to a formula, which of course it can't be, is that what I do is become more and more autobiographical, more and more referring to the process of actually trying to communicate something, rather than trying to communicate something. If that doesn't probably make grammatical sense, but seen and not seen became largely, a lot of it was about how and why I was writing this book. Like, what's going on for me right now that I have to write this book? The book became about itself.
Right.
So that, and that seemed to be a way to avoid this kind of dissembling and this posing and this creating of a projected identity that will have social clout and currency that we were talking about earlier, the Kubrick syndrome, if I can call it that, self-mythologizing. It's basically honesty, but of course honesty isn't something that you can just decide to do, because you have to know yourself to be honest about yourself. But I think that the whole Institute of Art has gradually become the opposite of that. Like in the early days, pre what we think of as art, artists didn't even sign the work.
Right.
There was no identification with it. So I think it was
fresh.
Yeah, and I think it was more about the process than the product. The product was left at the end of it, but it was this self-immersive process of self-discovery through knitting or through mosaics or writing or filmmaking or whatever it was. Process of self-discovery at the end of which is this product, but you don't have to even put your name on it because you've already moved on to the next thing.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit idealistic in our current time, but still as a possibility. It seems like the inverse of propaganda.
Yeah, no, I it's sort of like the Buddhist thing of making the mandala and throwing it out, and, you know, it's about impermanence. It's not about eating this thing that's going to last. It's the process of creating beauty and the process of letting go of beauty.
Yeah.
Like, those two things are part of the same thing, and, you know, and that's, it's got some of that same idea to it of getting back to the process of expression is the end, not the means.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting thing. I mean, that's not, I will admit I haven't thought about these issues in a bit, but it's an interesting conversation. It's like making me really think about stuff that sadly is not part of a lot of what we tend to talk about day to day. You know, it's which is really valuable.
Yeah, well, it's anti-culture actually what we're expressing here, because culture is all about creating edifices that will we can leave behind. It's the denial of the death syndrome that is behind the culture, I think, or has been said to be, and I think it's a convincing case for how basically we just create beliefs and artifacts to try and stave off the awareness of our impermanence. So yeah, to embrace impermanence would be anti-cultural in itself.
It certainly is as good an argument for what culture is as I've heard. I mean, it's. I think there's certainly truth in it. I mean, because I don't know that there's anything is stronger than the desire to deny. I mean, other than very short-term survival, I think the next step is I don't want to ever die.
Yeah.
And so I do think that colors everything that human beings do is denial of death. You know, very, very few people ever truly get to that place of embracing impermanence and fully. I mean, I definitely listen to some of the podcasts. Is there any of your writing that you think speaks to some of that? Because I would want to read whatever that would be.
I would think that Seen and Not Seen is the best place to start. And it begins writing about movies, and it ends writing about my brother, who I don't know if I was reminded of at the beginning of this conversation, because you have that painting with the guy in the top hat. And my brother was a dandy who wore a top hat. And anyway, he died in 2010, and the circumstances of his death really demanded an inquiry for me. And so there was a sort of arc of discovery of exploring my relationship to movies and culture, and then extending what I discovered outward to my brother, and how he became this self-combusting celebrity. So yeah. I think Seen and Not Seen has it all in that regard. And
I will start there. I would be very, you know, obviously I need to go, which makes me feel sad, but yeah, this has been one of the more interesting conversations I've had in a really long time. I mean, I hope it's interesting to people listening to it. I know that I feel there's going to be a lot bouncing from my head for a bit, and I like that. I mean, I feel like that's not part of most discourse that you have in life, so I'm really grateful for it.
I'm grateful too, and I'm grateful that you felt that way, because that's the aim of the podcast, really, is to have conversations that don't happen. Yeah. I mean, they happen for me every week. That's why I do the podcast. But
yeah.